Hello, fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to a new edition of my Old Kentucky Podcast. My name is Robert Connie, and joining me on this show is Jasmine Smith. For some reason, the start of this show did not record correctly. I am going to blame Cookie the Cat, my cat who jumped onto the keyboard at the beginning of the show. But we did start at some point at the beginning. The topics for the show will start with Jasmine kind of just sliding right in, talking about policing and policing issues in Louisville. We started recording right at the beginning of her segment, so you won't have missed basically anything. I'm pretty sure no good information will be missed, just some fun banter between the two of us to start the show. That is the first thing that we're going to be talking about on this show. The second thing we're going to be talking about on this show is HB 829, the 2024 medical cannabis bill that passed the Kentucky legislature. I'm going to be talking about that second. That's what's on the show. Sorry about the confusion here to start the show, but without any further ado, here we go.
Talking about bills and such. So in February, the DOJ presented a first draft of a consent decree for the city of Louisville after what's been a two-year-long investigation after Breonna Taylor's death and protests that followed. So right now, negotiations are happening, but we do know that if Louisville agrees to what's been drafted, the city's compliance will be overseen by a federal judge and an independent monitor. So that's how the consent decree would be overseen, basically. But these negotiations generally take a while, so we may not have an agreement for a while. I think negotiations begin around the end of February, so that's been 2 months now, but I think they could probably take 6 to 9 months from what I've seen. There was the DOJ has also been having these sporadic community meetings, and there was one 2 weeks ago, and people were upset that no community member is involved in the negotiation process, and that DOJ has advised the city to keep the details of it private. The process involves U.S. attorneys, so those are prosecutors on the federal level, the mayor, the county attorney, and the chief of police. And so, you know, all of those people involved are law enforcement, except the mayor, but he's LMPD's boss. So
most of the law enforcement, if not all of it, well, not all of it, but a good chunk of it reports up to him. All of LMPD goes all the way up to him because he's over the police chief, right?
Right. So the others are, you know, law enforcement officers, and he's their boss. So everyone involved is essentially law enforcement. So I do understand people's concerns about the lack of input from a community member or just someone from a different type of agency. But I don't see that being something that's going to happen. The results of their pattern and practice investigation were released over a year ago at this point in March of 2023. So they found that LMPD had a pattern of civil rights violations, especially against Black residents. And LMPD received recommendations from a consulting firm, which as of February 2024, when these negotiations started, the article that I read said that LMPD's online dashboard said that those recommendations are 81% implemented.
So this dashboard is related to the pattern and practice investigation, which was done by an independent firm, but not by the Department of Justice, just to be clear, right?
Yes.
Right. So the 81% implemented were like the internal reforms that basically LMPD and the city kind of like agreed that they would do outside of kind of like oversight by another branch of government or another, you know, higher level of government.
Yeah. And so that's kind of what's going on with the consent decree. But while all of this is ongoing, the FOP has come to an agreement with the city to increase officer pay and also throw out officer discipline if complaints are taking too long to be investigated. And that news came out just a couple weeks ago, and the contract goes to Metro Council for approval. But when it was released, it was made available on a Thursday before a special council meeting was called for the following Monday. And if you wanted to speak at it, you had to be signed up by Friday. So this is kind of another example of, you know, closed door negotiations from our city that no one is able to be a part of.
It's frustrating in that it's like kind of like a cracked door policy, right? You know, it's not like it's a closed door, right? If you want to speak, you can. You just have to register the day after the thing drops, and you have to speak then just a few days later. So, you know, people are like, oh, you know, you didn't give the public a chance to you know, speak. They're like, oh yeah, we gave the public a chance to speak, and then forget to mention that.
Yeah. Well, in a lot of places, these kind of negotiations are the negotiations for the contract themselves are public, and those are private here. Much like, you know, like the search for the chief of police that was private in Louisville, whereas other cities have had public searches and things like that. And so I think it's just another example of that.
Yeah. When it comes to stuff like that, I wish I knew more about what the statistics looked like in terms of. I do know that there are lots of cities that do it open, and I do know that even the police union negotiations are more open than that. And I also know that many cities also still practice like a closed situation. And what do the cities look like? Are there cities that are more, you know, like moderate, like Louisville often is? Do it like this. I mean, how much further do we have to go to implement this in our city? Obviously, it would be better if we had those sort of open situations. But, like, you know, it's I don't know. I don't know how broad the practice is. I wish it were more broad, and I wish we would do it. But I wonder how broad it is nationally.
Yeah, and I'm not sure either. But, those are a lot of concerns that our community has raised with both the consent decree negotiation and this FOP contract negotiation. But, you know, some people were able to make it to the meeting and be heard and presented a list of demands to the council. And so no action was taken at that meeting. I believe that they're set to vote on it at this Thursday's meeting. So, of course, the big issue with the new contract is that many officers may avoid discipline if complaints are not investigated within 180 days. They can be granted an additional 90, and then there are some exceptions to, you know, the time limit, like officer-involved shootings or a state of emergency, or then there's a more subjective exception called complexity of the case. And so Metro government, under this like proposed agreement, Metro government can continue and complete its investigation into a complaint if it's past the 180 days and note what discipline would have been issued if completed timely. However, they won't issue the discipline to any member who's subject of the investigation if it's outside the time limits.
Yeah, there's a lot of issues I see with this. I mean, I'm not alone in thinking there's a lot of issues with this. But, I mean, to me, it just, like, all the most obvious stuff applies. Like, it's bad that, you know, people can get away with stuff, that, you know, things that, you know. But it also, like, it incentivizes, like,
a rushed investigation, potentially.
On one side, but then also if somebody knows they've done something wrong,
like, or to not investigate at all.
Being a bad cop and keeping bad records and not doing a good job of, like, you know, dragging your feet is another way to, like,
avoid discipline. Yeah, there's all kinds of problems with it. I think the biggest one being that they could get away with things, but it creates a lot of others as well.
Absolutely.
And so Ed Harness, he is Louisville's inspector and oversight czar from the DOJ. He said he did not anticipate any conflict with this rule and the dissent decree because complaints will be investigated in a reasonable time under the consent decree. Harness is an attorney and a former police officer, and he's had some really interesting things to say about LMPD. So, like, I have a couple quotes here. He said, there's a level of arrogance within the department that they still aren't grasping the problem. And I've been surprised at the lack of contrition that I've seen when I've met with the command staff. There will be some acknowledgement that we should exist, but is it really that bad?
That's very telling, but also not surprising to me, given just the broad pushback that the police department seems to have about any sort of reform that happens at all. I mean, I think a lot of the political leadership has been surprised by this as well and has tried to kind of mask it. And I think, like, one of the reasons Louisville has had such a hard time, even going back to the last mayor's administration, is, like, in a lot of other cities, there has been a little, like, okay, the police department has kind of realized internally that they need to do better by their community. And I think, like, all of the work for reform has basically fallen on political leadership, and they basically have been forced to kick and drag the police department to any level of reform. And there has been no, like, work with at all that I've seen from the political leadership, which just demands, like, better political leadership. But of course, that's great if you can get it. You know what I mean? Like, it's just hard to do it without any partnership whatsoever from the police department, who doesn't seem interested in providing any of it.
Right. He also said that LMPD is unprepared for a consent decree. He said, I think the biggest challenge in Louisville is that the department is not prepared for how much policing is going to change for them in their daily lives. I don't think they understand all the changes that are going to take place. Every city that's been under a consent decree believes they can somehow prevent it or make it less impactful. So these quotes came from an article about Ed Harness by Josh Wood in the Courier Journal from August of 2023. And I thought the whole thing just about him was a really good read. And so that's where I got those from. But finally, you know, speaking of officer misconduct complaints, this was just like a little news update that happened to come this week. An LMPD officer suspension just got reduced. Kevin Casper, he was a sergeant who denied knowing about Slushy Gate, which was where officers were like attacking people with slushies on the sidewalks from their cars. And he said that he didn't know about it, but there was evidence that he was in a group chat with his division where videos of the slushy attacks were shared by his officers. And he was suspended for it, but that suspension got pretty drastically reduced by the merit board this week. So, an officer misconduct tidbit that seems to go along with you know, maybe being resistant to change.
I mean, it's like all of the all of the organs internal to the city are set up to, like, basically allow the police department to do whatever they want to, and it has been that way for a very long time. And really, like, the solution in a lot of other cities is, like, you have to bring in the federal government. And that's what has happened here. And, I mean, there are mixed results, and we've talked about this a bunch before. But, yeah, it is, like, it's likely going to be a bit of a shock to the local police department that there is now someone exercising oversight where, like, they have just been able to avoid it in basically every case in recent memory. So, We'll see what happens. It's
And, you know, as we're moving into this consent decree era for LMPD, we also have this new bill in House Bill 5 that, you know, banned street camping along with several other harsh reforms. So I think it will be interesting to see how Louisville's law enforcement policies, what they will look like on some measures of this bill, like how they will treat camping cases and things like that, because, you know, even though the bill passed, you know, prosecutors and police departments kind of have their own policies for how they police, how they charge. And so I'm interested to see how we're going to deal with some of those harsh punishments with everything that we have coming down the pipeline and trying to improve policing and reform it, and also overcrowded jails from this bill. So
another thing that can't really be overstated in the midst of all this is it's a requirement for any of this reform to happen from the federal government that the Department of Justice remain, you know, in the hands of Democrats. We do have a consent decree, but I mean, if it basically becomes toothless if, you know, someone who is significantly more law and order like Donald Trump becomes the president again, which is just another, you know, when you're voting for president still really matters, even though.
Yeah.
You know, that level of government is one that we talk about all the time. So, you know, all of that kind of hinges, all of this police reform does really hinge on that. So if that's something you care about, think about that when you vote for president.
Yeah. The federal judiciary and DOJ, those are both super important depending on who's president.
I mean, and there's so much, I mean, I don't know, this is another whole subject, but like if you want to talk about homelessness, like the Department of the Interior, HHS, like all of the, like, you know, what's the urban government? I can't remember. There's like a urban affairs. I forget the name of the cabinet. Man, I'm losing my mind. Anyways, all of these big cabinets that are housing the federal government and have a bunch of money that flow through them, they're all really important, and they do a lot of good work here locally. And so, you know, having them work in some level towards solving problems is good for all of us. Yeah.
Yeah.
HUD, Housing and Urban Development. There you go. I got it. Thought about it. Anything else about LMPD? I think you had one more, right? One more thing to say? Or was that it?
Nope, that was the last thing.
All right. Good updates, Jasmine. I appreciate it. This is definitely a story I've thought a bunch about and been like, wonder where we're at with that. Now I feel up to date. And that's thanks.
Yeah, it feels any news and updates about it feel very like few and far between. And a lot of people like haven't really reported on a lot of it. I had trouble even finding out things like when a consent decree was expected or when Metro Council was meeting about this FOP contract. So it's all been kind of out of the news a little bit right now.
Yeah. And that actually has a little bit in common with the thing that I wanted to talk about this week, which is this year's HB 829, which is the 2024 medical cannabis bill, which is one of those things that I had a lot of trouble tracking because it went through a lot of changes. It seemed like a lot of things were happening with it. It seemed like one thing was happening one day, one person was opposing it, the next day they were tepidly supporting it, some group. I mean, it's been all over the place. So I kind of wanted to just hammer it down for myself and share what I learned with you and everyone else. So this is HB 829. So it is a bill that passed at the very end of the legislative session this year, which is a bill that makes modifications to the medical marijuana system. Of course, the medical marijuana system is not yet online. You cannot.
We don't have it yet.
You cannot use medical cannabis legally here in Kentucky quite yet. But as we've thought about this, the system that we set up, there were some tweaks and modifications that some people wanted as they thought about them. Some of them were good and some of them were not very good. And so how this piece of legislation came together is something I want to talk about. The biggest, best, good thing that came out of HB 829 is a change that moves up the date at which registrations can begin for the program to August. So this was scheduled to kind of launch at the beginning of 2025. And that was like everything was going to start. You could use medical cannabis legally. You could grow medical cannabis if you had a license. You could apply for a license. All of it was supposed to come online in January. Of course, that timeline doesn't really make a lot of sense because if you're able to legally use cannabis starting in January, but nobody's been licensed to sell it, nobody's been licensed to grow it, nobody's been licensed to distribute it, nobody's been licensed to process it, there will be nothing for you for 6 to 8 months. So this bill, what it does is it moves up a lot of the pre-work that needs to happen with the medical cannabis in order for it to be ready to go for people to start using it if they have the correct documentation starting in January of 2025.
That's good.
Yeah, that's good. And this reform was part of a different bill that was called SB 337. That bill was sponsored by Stephen West and David Yates. And that bill also, the other big thing that that bill did was expand the number of conditions under which medical cannabis can be prescribed. So SB 337 was a very good bill. It did this big change. It also expanded the number of conditions. Of course, Kentucky legalized medical cannabis last year, but it had the most restrictive set of conditions in the entire country. There is no medical cannabis system in the country, any state in the country that has a more restrictive condition list. So Stephen West, David Yates thought to expand that. I think it probably was more David Yates, but you know, you got to have a Republican's name on it to get it to go anywhere. So pick Stephen West.
Go for Stephen West.
What was Stephen West? And that was the bill. HB 829 that ended up passing incorporated that one element. It did not incorporate the expanded conditions. It did incorporate the moving up of the timeline. However, it also included all the provisions of the original HB 829, which was not a good bill. The original HB 829 ultimately was sponsored by Jason Nemes, Beverly Chester Burton, and Patrick Flannery. That bill allowed governments and school districts to opt out of the medical cannabis program, and also would require participants in the medical cannabis program to consult annually with a pharmacist about their participation in order to stay in good standing and continue to use cannabis legally. We don't do this with, like, you know, blood pressure medication or antidepressants or anything else. You know, you just take them until, you know, you and your doctor decide you don't need them anymore. But this program, that the reform that Jason Nemes et al. Wanted to implement was to basically force patients to continue to get a, you know, okay from a pharmacist annually, and also to give localities and school districts the ability to opt out of the program. So even further restricting the program. It's not great. It's not a good bill. Just before I talk about more about this, I did want to make a note that there are some exceptions that are written into the bill. So any business that's licensed to sell medical cannabis before a locality opts out, so, you know, we move this date up and localities obviously have a chance to opt out. This is all happening kind of at the same time. Localities are going to be able to kind of override people who register up until the start of 2025. So say I'm just going to pick a random town. Say it's like Madisonville. And if anybody's in Madisonville who is listening and you're saying, hey, my town would never do that, I apologize. But like, say that there's somebody who wants to operate a dispensary in Madisonville and they put in for a registration and they are granted one. But then, you know, Madisonville's like local government in October is like, nah, we don't want to participate. Their decision in October would override the license that was issued to that dispensary, and that would make that license void. But if, you know, the city doesn't get its stuff together, it's like it's past the new year, it's February of 2025 now. Now they want to opt out of it. If that dispensary has a license, the locality's opt out no longer overrides that license. So as long as a business is licensed before the locality opts out, as long as it's after the start of the year, their license is good. Clear as mud. Makes sense, Jasmine?
Yes.
Okay. So there is this kind of like timeline situation that's going on. So, I mean, it's kind of annoying and frustrating that we're making this thing legal, but only partially, and giving local governments the ability to opt out, and basically, like, wet and dry is what we use for alcohol. Like, I don't know, what should we call it? Like, lit and not lit. Nobody's allowed to smoke, I guess. So I don't know. I don't know what we call
green
it.
And
red.
Yeah.
Green and red county. Sure. It's like a stoplight and a marijuana. Yeah. Okay. So that is frustrating. And the school district thing is also really annoying. You know, I mean, I don't know. I don't really understand, like, except for a moral panic, like, what the point of it is. Under the bill, schools who do not opt out of the program are also required to develop an administration process, and they have to document all that, which seems to be, you know, encouraging school districts to kind of, like, decide to opt out, because it's like, okay, you can opt in, but you got to do more work. And it's like, well, I guess we don't want to do more work, and seems like something that would likely get us in trouble, so let's just opt out of it, especially smaller and mid-sized districts that are moderate to more conservative. That just seems to be like pushing them towards opting out. So that's very frustrating. So anyways, that's what the original HB 829 did, more of these restriction type things. And that caused many Democrats to speak out and vote against this bill when it came up for a vote originally. So the bill passed the House originally. It was a very partisan vote. Most of the Democrats voted against it. Some of the Democrats voted for it. After HB 829 was passed in the House originally, the Senate inserted those licensing reforms, which, you know, were good. They didn't insert the condition expansion again, so that wasn't as good. But the licensing changes were enough to get the bill kind of through in a bipartisan fashion. I think enough people kind of realized that those were more important than, and like the opt-out stuff was probably going to pass anyway. And just getting these licensing reforms in so the program would go smoothly at the start was worth it. So the Senate passed it in a bipartisan fashion. And when it made it back to the House with those changes, the House again voted in a bipartisan fashion. There were still some Republicans and a few Democrats that also voted against it. So the vote number actually wasn't significantly changed. It was just the people who voted for it were quite a bit different. Kentucky Normal, who is one of the groups I watch most closely on cannabis legislation, Normal is like a long-standing national organization that is, I think it's the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, I think is what Normal stands for, and that's Kentucky's chapter of that. They've been around for a very long time advocating for, you know, legality of cannabis long before it was as popular as it is now. Anyways, that group has initially had HB 829 as a strong opposed and in SB 337 as strongly favored. And so once they kind of looped all those things together, they ended up writing this really nice explainer and were just like, I don't know. It passed. I think that the writing was kind of on the wall. I don't think that they really called their members to push for an opposition after the good parts were wrapped into the bill like they probably would have if 829 had stood on its own legs, even if they didn't necessarily agree with the bill at the end of the day, knowing that there was some good stuff in it and it likely was going to pass anyway. The Governor Beshear did sign it into law, so it is now a law. It did make it through the session. Since the session has ended, Governor Beshear also announced last week that there would be a lottery system for licenses in the medical cannabis programs. So this licensing thing, there, you know, I think we did talk a little bit about this last year, but there are several types of licenses that the program, you know, makes legal. There's four tiers of cultivators. I think that the tiers have to do with the size of plot, the amount of plants that you want to cultivate to sell for medical cannabis. There's processors, there's producers, there's dispensaries, safety groups. I think that's all of them, but there might be a few more. And there's limited number of all of those groups except for safety. I think that there can be an infinity number of safety groups, but all of the other licenses are limited. And so if there are more applicants than there are licenses available, the governor, whose job it is to do this kind of stuff, promulgated, his administration promulgated regulations that said we're going to do this via lottery, which is a pretty popular way to do it. It's the thing that's kind of worked a lot of other places, just a straight lottery to see who's going to get them. That lottery is going to be held on October 1st. So if you are interested in starting a marijuana business here in Kentucky, that is when you would need to put in for a license. I think it's good that Kentucky took this step of legalizing medical cannabis last year, of course, but it's really annoying, Jasmine. I don't know. I want to hear if you have more thoughts about this, but it's really annoying to me that we immediately are taking steps backwards. So we did something good and we just can't let it sit. we have to make it worse before it's even started. I do think more clarity around regulations is a good thing. So, you know, making some of these regulations a little bit more clear and making them so they have a better timeline. But we can't, like, have anything that's just a clean win. We have to be like, all right, we made a smart reform. We also made, like, three bad reforms. And that just seems to be the way it has to work here in Kentucky with our legislature. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm glad that the licensing reform happened, but adding it to that bill is just, I don't know, another like Republican power move, because it kind of removed some people's opposition to it, and it kept advocacy groups for wanting to go all in on strongly opposing it, because it now, you know, does a good thing as well. And so it's just something that the Republican legislature can do to ensure that something bad is also going to pass.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree. I mean, it's really annoying. But I guess the solution to this problem is for better people to win election to legislative office, which is easier said than done. Yeah. All right. Well,
yeah,
that's what we had to talk about this week. You know, right after the session, Derby week, there's a lot of sports.
It's a little slow around here.
It's not. It's actually like the newspapers are quite busy because there's a lot of like features reporting, a ton of sports reporting, because, you know, the one professional sports league we have in the state of Kentucky at the top tier is like in active participation right now. And that's like pretty decent. You know, our Racing Louisville, I think, are they still undefeated, Jasmine? I think that they've only won a couple of times, but I don't think they've lost.
They won their first match on Saturday, which was the same day as Thunder. So they had like a Thunder over Louisville match and won 5-1. And that was their first win, but still undefeated.
Yeah, so they've had a lot of ties.
A lot of draws.
Of course, college basketball, lots of turnover. Both the men's coaches for University of Kentucky and University of Louisville have new coaches this year. The University of Kentucky's women's coach is brand new. So there's all kinds of sports news, all kinds of features reporting for the Derby. And, you know, politics marches on, but, you know, it hasn't been top of the news for a lot of people lately. But us, we're still talking about it. And we found things to talk about.
Yeah, we're still here.
And we're going to continue to do that. So, all right. Jasmine, how can people get a hold of us?
They can find us on Twitter and Instagram at @myoldkypod. They can like our Facebook page and listen to our podcast on the podcast app of their choice. We also have a newsletter you can subscribe to at tinyletter.com/myoldkentuckynewsletter. And we have a Patreon page where you can support what we're doing for as little as $1 a month. You can do that at patreon.com/myoldkentuckypodcast. And last but not least, we're part of the Dimcast Network and the Forward Kentucky Network.
All right, everybody. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.